It's March 6, 1970, a Friday. Tara Robbins is sitting at a workbench in the basement of a townhouse in Greenwich Village. Next to him is a friend. Her name is Diana Alton. She is 28 years old. Diana and Terry are surrounded by dynamite, nearly enough to blow up an entire city block.
Diana and Terry are members of the Weathermen, a group of radicals protesting the war in Vietnam. They believe the only way to stop the war is to wage war in their own country. Terry is new to bomb making, and so is Diana. She's a teacher. She grew up in a small town in the Midwest. She was a straight-A student. Her family is wealthy, the richest family in Dwight, Illinois. From the outside looking in, the Altons look a lot like a Norman Rockwell painting. But Diana rejects all of that. She's never been comfortable being a part of that image. And so here she is, in a basement, full of dynamite, just minutes away from blowing up her own life. I'm Muskan Shah.
And I'm Hope Drew. And this is Shoe Leather, an investigative podcast that digs up stories from New York City's past to find out how yesterday's news affects us today.
This season, we're going to 1970 Greenwich Village. A townhouse suddenly explodes, and authorities find out that it's the ground zero for the operations of the Weathermen, a radical group of young revolutionaries who use violence to bring the war home.
Diana Alton didn't have a troubled childhood. Her family was close. She went off to college and eventually became a teacher. Why would someone like that, someone who came from such a privileged life, join a militant group determined to blow up the establishment? This is Shoe Leather, Season 7, Revolution Gone Wrong.
You're listening to Episode 2, The Teacher.
Find out how a girl from a small town become a radical, we start at the beginning, in Diana's hometown, Dwight, Illinois. So, I take a 13-hour train ride from New York City to rural Illinois.
Now, I think I'm the only one getting off from this station.
I bet you are.
Yeah.
It feels like I've entered a scene from an old-timey movie. An empty train station, cornfield all around. No one in sight, until Mary and Bill Flott pulled up. There was the Dwight Historical Society.
Well, we'd start by taking it to the museum.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if you want to ride around town and see some of the places.
They've agreed to take me on a tour to show me the place where Diana was born in 1942.
This house right here was Diana Alton's home right there.
Uh-huh. He's pointing at a red brick house, half covered in vines.
The Altons owned this land, and they donated the land for the school.
Here, everyone knows the Altons. The family owned a bank. Diana's father served on the local school board, too. At home, the Altons were also politically minded. It wasn't unusual for them to talk politics at dinner table. Carol Biondi is Diana's sister.
She was very smart. Sometimes my father would put her straight A report card up on the mantle and she'd walk over and take it down.
In Diana's high school photo, she's smiling. Her light brown hair is in a bob. She has green eyes. From the outside looking in, she has a great life. She lives in a big house. She has a nanny. And she even learns to ride horses. But Diana's comfortable home life actually troubles her. She's sheltered, and she knows it.
It wasn't very dramatic in Illinois. I mean, in Dwight, it wasn't. There was, you know, there was one black person who delivered ice cubes to our ice boxes. And there was one Jewish family that ran a dry goods store in the town. And there wasn't poverty.
Diana feels bad for those who have less than her. But it isn't until she traveled 2,700 miles away that she would start to see the world in a whole new way.
Fast forward to 1963. Dinah is 21 years old. She's just graduated from college. She signs up for a volunteering program, kind of like the Peace Corps, but it's run by the Quakers. Her assignment? Chichicastenango. It's a remote village in Guatemala, and it's poor. Dinah teaches Spanish to indigenous women. She also teaches them crafts so that they can earn a living. Dinah's family visits her twice in Guatemala. Here's my cousin, Dinah's cousin.
So when her parents came down, she made them stay in the worst hotel she could find so that there wouldn't be a perception that she was a privileged individual. And she really struggled with that.
Dinah's dad sends her money to buy a horse so she can get around more easily. But she tells him to give the money to a convent instead. And he does. Dinah is also in Guatemala during one of the most violent periods in the country's history.
The United States pledges itself to support not merely political opposition to communism, but to help to alleviate conditions in Guatemala and elsewhere.
The country is in a bloody civil war, and Dinah is in the middle of it. On one side, a guerrilla army of mostly farmers and students. On the other, a military dictator backed by the US government. Dinah witnesses violence and death, and she blames the US government for what she sees. 2 years later, she's back at home.
So many of the people we spoke with told us Dinah returns to the US a different person. She wants the world to be a more equitable place. But Guatemala introduces her to a villain in this story, her own government, a government she blames for so much of the suffering she sees. It's 1966. Dinah is now 24. She enrolled in a master's program at the University of Michigan. There, she meets a guy named Bill Ayers. He's a teacher at a small experimental school. He's 22.
We became very good friends, and she was strong, beautiful. She was natural with children. She fell into our little do-it-yourself preschool with a lot of gusto and a lot of confidence.
Together, they teach at the Children's Community School in the basement of the Quaker Center in Ann Arbor.
So the photos that I have in my mind, the things I remember, is kids climbing all over her and her reading a story to six kids. And she was, in many ways, worldly wise. I mean, she spoke Spanish, she had lived in Guatemala. And we were, as I say, we were good friends. We were colleagues in this project. And only later did we become lovers.
Bill says the school was spontaneous and free. They let the kids rule. One person we talked to said it can be a little chaotic, like Lord of the Flies. But after 2 years, the school is having problems. Money is tight, enrollment is down. Dinah does everything she can to save it, but it still closes.
People we spoke to say this was another major turning point for Dinah. She saw liberals, people on the left, people who are like-minded, would support the school. And when they don't, she's devastated. That's when she realized there are two kinds of people. Those who accept the status quo and those who are willing to take action, do whatever it takes. And Dinah is on that side. The ones who are willing to go to war to fight the system. It's 1968. The Vietnam War is in its 13th year.
From late January to early April 1968, a determined group of 6,000 Marines and Allied troops held out against a besieging force of 20,000 North Vietnamese.
To Dinah, it's a familiar story of what she saw in Guatemala.
We became very, very focused and on the war in Vietnam as the war in Vietnam exploded.
War demonstrations on college campuses and in cities from Los Angeles to Washington. draft card burnings became common, and the chant of "Hell no, we won't go" was the theme of the protest generation.
The SDS, or Student for a Democratic Society, is ramping up its protests. They are the largest protest group on college campuses. Diana found her people in the SDS, a community that share her value. Bill is already a leader in the group.
So in 68, we were set back. It was a crisis for the anti-war movement.
On March 16, 1968, American troops entered the village of My Lai in Vietnam and murdered hundreds of innocent Vietnamese men, women, and children.
Crisis for the student movement, a crisis for democracy, because the country was against the war, but the war would grind on. So how do you stop it? And we split up.
The SDS split into two groups. One continued to protest and organize, while the other believed that an armed struggle against the government is the only way to create a revolution. They call themselves the Weathermen. Bill is firmly on the side of the Weathermen, and so is Diana.
By 1969, Diana is 27. As a member of the Weathermen, she's getting radicalized in all sorts of ways, even in her relationships. The Weathermen adopt a policy called smash monogamy. The idea is that romantic partnerships create a kind of loyalty to each other, and this competes with loyalty to the cause. And that means monogamous relationships had to go. Mark Rudd was a leader and one of the founding members of the Weathermen.
Everybody was fucking with everybody else. Not everybody, especially the guys. The smash monogamy benefited the men more than the women, I think.
But the idea of smash monogamy actually originated from women, the Weather Woman. They thought monogamy was just another way for women to be dominated. The solution is revolution. Women have to break free from one man, from one relationship, from the whole structure. Naomi Jaffe was a Weather Woman. She knew Diana and Bill.
We as an organization, men and women, were very interested in experimenting with different kinds of structures. We could see that the ones we were brought up with and the ones that we were immersed in were all messed up.
In practice, that meant rotation of sexual partners, group sex, or what they called wargasms. Casual sex to prove political allegiance to the collective. It meant same-sex individuals sleeping with each other. In his memoir, Bill Ayers remembers a night when he, his best friend Terry Robbins, Diana, and another woman, quote, bedded together, end quote. He woke up being held by Terry. He wrote that they felt like an army of lovers. Smashing monogamy was supposed to be a political program to make women whole, free. What it became, however, was something else.
Smash monogamy also did mean that there was pressure on relationships that were good relationships and that people were happy with to break them up. I don't know if that happened with Bill and Diana. It probably did.
In his memoir, Bill described Diana confronting him directly. He'd been away for days, without even calling. When he's back, Diana has something to say.
She asks him, "If this is liberation, why don't I feel free?"
Diana is also drifting apart from the people she loves, her family. They don't hear from her for months at a time. But then, she'll resurface. Here's Mike Alton again, Diana's cousin. He's still living Dwight.
You know, and every once in a while she'd show up with some of her friends, and I'm guessing they were SDS individuals. And it sounded as though the the encounters weren't real pleasant.
In December 1969, Diana goes home for Christmas. She showed up at her cousin Mike's house, and this time, she's alone.
The doorbell rang. I got up to answer it. Everybody else was around the dining room table. Opened the door, saw her. It took me a couple seconds to realize who I was looking at.
Diana's long hair, now cut to the shoulders. She's thinner, too.
I brought her into the dining room, and everybody was shocked to see her. Now, I can't tell you much about the conversation after we sat down, because I was a little bit in awe, but I'm sure there were lots of questions about what's going on.
They ask her about where she's been and what she's doing. Diana mostly just answers their questions. It isn't unusual for her family to argue about politics, but at this point, she and her father can't agree on anything anymore, politically or otherwise. When he asks her what the revolution's endgame is, she has no answer. Diana doesn't stay in her hometown long. She goes back to her friends, to the weathermen, to her boyfriend Bill, the people who make more sense to her now than her own family.
How is the people in Alton family think about Bill Ayers?
I think he's a piece of shit.
Why?
Because I think that was probably a major reason she went down the path she did.
Mike isn't the only one who blames Bill for the path Diana takes. Her sister Carol told us the same thing.
She and Bill became a couple, and he really led her into this world. I blame him.
We talked to some of Diana's family, and it's very clear that they blame you for what happened. So do you know that? Like, what do you think of it?
I don't certainly blame her family for saying, well, it was Bill's fault. But I think that's also preposterous when you think about human agency and what people do. I mean, I remember my father saying, it was a damn shame that you hooked up with that Diana Outen. Why? Well, because she led me astray. Now, that's bullshit and nonsense. And it takes away the agency of the person.
It's February 1970. Bill and Diana's relationship is tense. They still live in Michigan. Terry, Bill's best friend, visits them. He's one of the so-called army of lovers and the leader of the Weathermen. He wants Diana to join him in New York.
This is where the story gets murky. What we know now, in 2026, is that Terry isn't just gathering a bunch of the Weathermen in New York. He's planning to build a bomb. But we don't know if Diana knows the plan. So we ask Bill.
Together with our colleague, we interviewed Bill many times. I even met him at his home in Chicago.
Hi. How are you?
Bill, how are you?
Great. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
This time, we sent him an email.
Dear Mr. Ayers, when Terry was visiting Michigan in late February and recruited Diana, did he tell her at the time that it was to build a bomb?
Bill writes back.
I doubt that any of us, not Terry, not anyone at the time, thought to say, come to New York and build a bomb. We were building a clandestine network involving the capacity to survive escalating repression and creating the capacity to fight the war machine more intensely. We were all involved in a multidimensional effort.
So maybe no one need to say it. Maybe they knew. Maybe they all knew.
It's March 1970. Bill visits Diana when she's in New York.
Diana and I had an evening together, and it was, bittersweet because we both felt that we were in a cataclysmic moment. And I just remember that it was, we were kind of talking about, where is this going? Where are we going? And being both confused and determined to somehow stay with it and somehow make make a difference and make a real concrete step towards ending the war. These were really, really, really tough times. And we had a sense that we weren't going to live past 30.
That would be the last time Bill sees Diana.
In the next episode, Ted Gold was raised in a leftist family and grew up going to communist summer camp. He loves music, and he's really passionate about politics. Soon, he'll take this passion to the next level.
Shoelather is a production of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. This episode was reported, written, and produced by me, Muskan Shah.
And me, Hope Zhu.
Joanne Farian is our executive producer and professor. Rachel Quester and Peter Leonard are our co-professors. Special thanks to Austin Mitchell, Brendan Klinkenberg, Asta Chaturvedi, Dana Shivas, Zoe Chase, Brent Katz, and Columbia Digital Libraries.
Sources for this episode include Fugitive Days by Bill Ayers and The Land of Eternal Spring by Alan Howard. Huge thanks to Thomas Powell, among the original journalists documenting this story, Liliana Golding, our expert on Guatemala, and Dwight Historical Society.
Shoelather's theme music, Squeegees, is by Ben Lewis, Doron Zunes, and Camille Miller, remixed by Peter Leonard.
Other music by Blue Dot Session. Our Season 7 graphic is created by me, Hope Zhu.